Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our second session with Professor John Burgess on Everyday Saints, Keeping the Faith in Hard Times. Today, we are eager to learn about Harald Wagner, who was imprisoned in communist East Germany for reading Western philosophy. Take it away.
Thank you, Sarah. Let's open this morning with a word of prayer. Lord, we thank you this morning for the gift of your church, for calling us here for worship and learning. We thank you for those saints who have touched our lives, those ordinary people who have been extraordinary to us in teaching us something about what it means to follow you. So we pray for your guidance this day that we may recommit ourselves to the ways of your Son. And we pray in his name, amen. I thought I'd open us this morning with one of Jesus' parables. This is from Matthew 13. Jesus put before them a parable saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like a grain of mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in his field. It is the smallest of all seeds, but when it has grown, is the greatest of shrubs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and make nests in its branches." So I want us to think about that parable this morning. A tiny seed, a mustard seed, the smallest of all seeds, and yet when it grows to be, at least in the Middle East, one of the greatest of trees, one of the greatest of plants, and that this is a parable, it's an analogy, it's a metaphor for the kingdom of God. That God takes something small and seemingly insignificant, something that is barely noticeable, and yet out of that introduces us, guides us, brings us into the fullness of God's glory. So the mustard seed that becomes the greatest of shrubs becomes a tree so that birds of the air come and make nests in its branches. All right, we'll have that in the back of our minds, but let's pick up where we were last time. We were talking about powers and principalities and how we as Christians are called to live in spiritual freedom, not allow the powers and principalities to manipulate us, to control us. This idea of powers and principalities that we find in the New Testament, this idea that there are human-created forces, we created them for good, but they come out of our control. They break off from our control and begin to control us. So we can create political orders and governments to do good, to order our life together in a healthy way, but they can spin out of our control and become dictatorial or even totalitarian. They begin to control us, as in the case of fascism in Europe, in the case of communism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. But then last time we talked about the many other more mundane powers and principalities. things even like being caught in traffic, where transportation is made for human well-being to get us from one place to another. And yet, when we're surrounded by other cars, when we're caught in a traffic jam, or even maybe when we're just on the interstate, but I was talking about how when there are people passing us at 75 or 80 miles an hour, and we'd like to go the speed limit at 65, we still find ourselves caught up, almost forced to go faster than we want to. It's what everybody else is doing. It becomes the norm, whether we like it or not. It becomes a bigger power, a principality that we no longer control, but it begins to control us. So we could use many examples of how we find ourselves caught up in powers and principalities that begin to control us instead of allowing us to control them. And then the call, the challenge for the Christian life is, how do I live in that kind of world? How do I live with a sense of freedom? How do I live in a way that I maintain my integrity? I maintain my capacity to be free in the Lord. I maintain my capacity to be true to what is good and excellent and right. So they are the themes for the series that we're having together for these weeks. And this morning, as Sarah said, I would like to turn my attention to a particular individual who has taught me something about ordinary holiness, ordinary saintliness, a person who will never be canonized, a person who won't ever be celebrated as a great saint of the church. In that sense, an ordinary person, and yet in his own way, an extraordinary person, whose story I'd like to share with you this morning. But let's begin by going back to where I was ending last time, a couple of slides. So we're looking at this passage from Matthew 25 that's familiar, I think, probably to all of us. Jesus, looking at the nations of the world, the peoples of the world. I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. I died and you buried me. Well, actually, that last phrase is not in Matthew 25, but was added later by Christians who thought that this also was an act of mercy to bury the dead, to provide for a decent burial for every person who died, that this also was a way of showing the love of Christ. Feeding, giving drink, clothing, welcoming, visiting, and also providing for a decent burial of the dead. Next slide, please. And as you did it to one of the least of my brethren, you did it to me. Because before the judgment seat of Christ, the peoples, the nations say, when did we see you hungry? When did we see you thirsty? And Jesus replies, whenever you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. So one way from the beginning of the Christian faith that Christians have cultivated their capacity for freedom, cultivated their capacity to resist the powers and principalities, has been through simple acts of love and kindness. Ordinary acts, nothing that seem earth-shaking, nothing that overthrow governments, nothing that change economic systems, and yet this confidence that when we devote ourselves to the least of these Christ brethren, that we are doing things in the name of Christ and for the sake of Christ. Next slide, please. So this slide's a little bit hard to see, but it is an illustration of a mural in a church in Germany that is called the Seven Acts of Mercy. We were to go back again to Matthew 25. Matthew 25 lists six acts of mercy. And then, as I said, Christians later added this seventh act of mercy, providing for a decent burial of the dead. And so you can kind of make out there on the left, a person is being given food and drink. The next scene over, someone is being clothed. The next scene over, someone is being welcomed, visited. The next scene, visiting those in
next scene, those who are ill and sick. And then to the very right, you can see someone helping to carry a casket. That last act of mercy, providing for the burial of the dead. So it came to be known as the seven act of mercy. Seven acts of mercy. Let's see if I can remember one without going back to the Matthew 25 slide. So to feed the hungry, to get a drink, to the thirsty, to clothe the naked, to welcome the visitor, to visit those in the prison, and let's see, I'm up with five. I guess the care for the sick, we can always say that. Okay, and then to bury the dead. The seven acts of mercy. Next slide, please. Here's a little bit closer view of it. And when you notice, what's interesting about here on the left, someone being fed, given drink, someone being clothed, someone being welcomed, someone being visited in person. But what's interesting about the way that the recipients are depicted? Those who were receiving.
Mike, it's making it somehow muddled online, so maybe it would be closer to your voice.
Okay, we'll see if that happens.
Yeah, they have a gable.
They're the ones with a gable. They're the ones with the hands, so interesting that they are depicted, the ones doing the good deeds, not depicted as saints, but the ones who being served are depicted as though they were Christ. And so they are the least of Christ, but they are representing him. I think it's such a beautiful idea that Christian service and Christian freedom was the capacity to be put in the I got a little pepper.
Yeah.
And this is in your hand.
So the bottom.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think this is such a beautiful way of depicting what it means to be a Christian. not to look at myself and all the good things that I'm doing that make me saintly, but the privilege that I have of reaching out to those in need who represent Christ to me. And this is what cultivates my freedom. This is what cultivates my capacity, not simply to be controlled by the powers and principalities, but to break through that, to be able to live with integrity, to live with Christian truth and integrity in the face of a world that would want to manipulate me to do differently. All right, so next slide, please. Let's turn now to the person that I'd like to talk about this morning and the way that he cultivated spiritual freedom in the face of the powers and principalities of his time. So we're going to go back to the time of communist East Germany, the time of the division of Germany, the Berlin Wall. Have any of you been to Berlin? You've seen the Berlin Wall, so you have some picture of, there's still a memorial site there with portions of the wall that once divided Berlin. And I want us to think about what it must have been like to be a Christian during those years. The wall was built, I believe, in 1963. It was breached, and Germany was reunited after 1989, November 9th, I believe it was, 1989, that the wall started to come down. But for that time, after World War II, and especially after the building of the Berlin Wall in 1963, Christians in East Germany had to live under a communist totalitarian government. Now, in many ways, life in East Germany was still relatively comfortable. It had a relatively good standard of living. That wasn't the problem. The problem wasn't that people were hungry or impoverished. That was not their situation. They had a relatively good standard of living compared to the rest of the world. Decent apartments. If they saved up long enough, they could buy a small car. They had plenty of food to eat. They had relative prosperity, but they lived under the power and principality of a government that wanted to control everything, wanted to control where they could travel to, wanted to control how they were educated, wanted to control what they would think, wanted to control their attitudes toward other parts of the world, towards the United States or Western Europe, an ideological power and principality, an ideology that this is the way you think, this is the way you see the world, this is the way that you assume reality has been constructed from this Marxist, Leninist, communist perspective. So the wall was not simply a physical structure, but even today, East Germans whom I've gotten to know over the years will talk about the wall that was constructed in the head, the wall that was constructed in the mind that divided people into two parts, that divided the world into those of us who have the truth in the communist world and those who are exploiters and capitalists in the Western world. Next slide, please. Well, what we have so often in our minds is the Berlin Wall, but actually there was a wall, a border fence, a border area that separated the country as a whole. The wall as such was only in Berlin, the capital, but through the heart of Germany ran this border structure that divided East from West and made it nearly impossible for people in East Germany to cross over to West Germany. As time went on, with visas and government regulations, government agreements, there was more ability to get a visa to go for a time to West Germany, or for West Germans to come for a time to East Germany. But still, this was the wall, the fence, the border, the division that, as I say, was both physical and mental. A different way of growing up in the world with a different set of assumptions. Okay. Then those of us who are old enough to remember those days when things like the Olympics were celebrated with communist countries participating as well as the rest of the world. But we may remember, well, here's the East German team at a big sporting event. And there was, during those days of the Cold War, pretty intense competition. Sports were not just friendly competitions. It was the free world versus the communist world, in a sense, that was always being played out. And then always the accusations that the East German team and other communist teams were using doping and other ways of promoting their prowess athletically. We remember how strained not only politics, but even sports were during those days because of that wall between East and West. Next slide, please. So the German Democratic Republic, for a number of years, a small country of only about 16 million people at that time, but over the top, sporting victories as a way of promoting the prowess and strength and righteousness of the communist cause over and against the West. Well, this man, who I got to know over the years and have kept up with, Harald Wagner, he's now 72 years old. He grew up in that world. He grew up in that world of communist East Germany. And I want to tell his story and what he has taught me about spiritual freedom and living in a totalitarian society as a Christian. So he was born in a Christian family, and his family taught him the Christian faith at the same time that he, of course, had to attend the public schools in East Germany, where he was taught atheistic communist ideology. One of his big perplexities as he was growing up was whether there was a way to put those two things together. Was there a way to put together what he had learned as a Christian in his family and what he was learning at school as a communist? And of course, in many ways, the two could not be put together. They were diametrically opposed to each other. But one thing that interested him, one thing where he saw some overlap, was that communism, like Christianity, spoke of justice. Communism, like Christianity, spoke of having equality. Communism, like Christianity, spoke of a society where there was just relationships and people could live in harmony together. And this fascinated him, even though he had to reject most of communism, most of Marxism, because of its atheism and because of its ideology. Nevertheless, his concern for social justice was something that he thought was worth trying to put together with his Christianity. But how to do this? How to do this? Was there a way to put together both Christianity and call Marxism to its best insights for social justice? Interesting dilemma. So next slide, please. Well, he grew up in this world, he was selected by the East German authorities to be a sportsman, to be one of those who would be trained to be one of the leading sports figures in the country, to represent the country in international competitions. He himself did not quite make it to the Olympics, but he was one of those elite sportsmen that was chosen, selected to be trained to represent the greatness and power of communist East Germany to the rest of the world. But as he thought through his dilemma of how to work for a more just society, both out of his Christian convictions and out of what he thought Marxism at its best represented, he got interested in reading philosophy. And he found that as he got interested in reading philosophy to solve this dilemma in his life, that he wanted to read philosophy with other people who are interested in the same questions he was interested in. He wanted to find a group that would help him think together about what it would mean to have a just society in communist East Germany. So he got involved in a reading group, a small group of 5 to 8 people who would meet every couple of weeks or once a month and read a philosophical book together, some philosopher reflecting on what is a just society. A seemingly innocuous thing to do, to read books and to talk about them with other people. But this small group decided that in order to read what they needed to read, they also needed to read books that had been published in the West. Not just East German philosophers and not just Marxist philosophers, but also philosophers from West Germany and France and the United States and other parts of the world. They wanted to broaden their horizons as they thought about justice. They wanted to learn from the best sources of Western civilization, going back to Aristotle and Plato and through the Middle Ages, Thomas Aquinas, and up into the present. There was only one problem. The books that they wanted to read were illegal to read in East Germany. There was no way to get hold of them. And there was no way legally to have them shipped over, to check them out of a library, to find these books and to read them together. All they wanted to do was read them together. They weren't plotting a conspiracy. They weren't working to overthrow the government. They were thinking. But thinking is dangerous when you live under a totalitarian
regime. So what they did was to find a way to smuggle books from West Germany into East Germany. Whole story about how that system worked to smuggle books in, but they had certain couriers from West Germany. The short story is that you saw the fence between East and West Germany, and you saw the wall in Berlin. But there were certain highways that West Germans could take to drive through East Germany to West Berlin. So you're driving through the communist country to get to West Berlin, where the wall separated the West from the East. And of course, as in any country, as in the United States, on the way from West Germany to West Berlin through East Germany, there would be a rest stop or two. And they found a West German who would drop off books on the edge of one of these rest stops that then could be picked up by one of their people in East Germany, and so have access to these books. Well, he got caught. The members of the reading group came under suspicion. They were arrested. His house was searched. They had managed to smuggle in 500 books. He had only 8 or 9 of them. They had been clever about hiding them and distributing them and not having them all in one place. They'd managed to smuggle in 500 books, but they got caught, and he had 8 or 9 of them in his house. So for reading a book that I can find at the University of Pittsburgh Library, for reading a book that you can order online from Amazon, we're not talking about conspiratorial literature. We're talking about philosophers. And, you know, philosophy is hard to understand sometimes. These are pretty lofty ideas about what makes a society just. But just for trying to think in a different way and to expand his horizons, he was arrested, imprisoned. He was sentenced to a year in prison at this prison in Brandenburg, Germany, which incidentally was one of the most infamous prisons in East Germany. It had not simply political prisoners, but the worst of criminals in it. And he told me, I interviewed him a couple of years ago, he told me, I guess this is probably true of all prisons, a little bit that we might read in our popular media, but there's a hierarchy in every prison. And in his prison, it was the murderers who were at the top of the hierarchy. And the political prisoners, like he, were at the bottom of the hierarchy. He said the one thing that saved him was he'd been trained in sports. He was a big person. He was strong. In fact, he was taller and bigger and stronger than any of the thugs in the prison, and so they left him alone. But he was imprisoned and left behind his wife, who also was trained to be a sports person for the Olympics, left behind his wife and 2 children, ages 3 and 2. And he's sent to prison. In prison, he was able to get hold of a Bible. And his faith was reshaped by the parables of Jesus. He found himself drawn to these parables, such as the one we read this morning, how a mustard seed that is tiny and almost unnoticeable becomes the instrument by which God grows his kingdom. Parables like that gave him hope that perhaps he could be something like a mustard seed. Perhaps God could do something with him even in prison, where he was small, in the sense, not small physically, but insignificant from the point of view of German society, East German society, now imprisoned, now criminalized. But the parables of Jesus, how the kingdom of God might grow even under those difficult circumstances. So he began reading the Bible, and he began to find other prisoners who, like he, wanted to dream about a different kind of East Germany. Next slide. Now you can see a little bit more about how imposing the building is. It was a building that was also used by the Nazis during the 30s and the 40s to imprison political prisoners. So the tragedy of this happening again after World War II under the communists. Next slide. Yeah, I suppose what all prisons look like. Next. The small cell in which he was confined. And then after his imprisonment, after he was released, he no longer had a future. He was banned from any participation in sports. He was banned from teaching sports at the university where he had been based. But because of the Bible and because of his commitment to a just society, he decided after he came out of prison to go to seminary to learn again from the Christian tradition how to work for a just society. So he got more and more involved in the church, more and more involved in thinking about justice now from a Christian point of view. This church is a large church in Leipzig, Germany, and Huddled, my acquaintance, he and a group of other Christians began to organize prayer services in this church, prayer services for peace. They were a place where people who wanted a different kind of East Germany could gather and pray together. So this is interesting. He wanted to read books, and that proved to be dangerous, and he wanted to pray, and that proved to be dangerous. Because when you think other thoughts, and when you pray in the name of Christ, you are not simply fitting into the powers and principalities. So this big church, the St. Nicholas Church, St. Nikolai Kirche in Leipzig, these prayer services for peace began with only a handful of people, and then they began to grow and grow and grow until there were hundreds and even thousands of people gathering every week to pray for peace as an act of defiance against the communist government. Next slide. After they prayed together, they would light candles and they would go out onto the street and they would make a procession. They would march. Here they are in the main square in Leipzig, where the Rathaus, the government building is located. And again, no weapons, no conspiracy, no underhanded methods, simply praying and then quietly walking with candles was their way of saying, we're going to be free. We want to be free. We want a different society, and we want to be able to work freely for that different society. Next slide. Well, eventually, as those meetings, not only in Leipzig, but in other churches, began to draw more and more people, in 1989, the so-called peaceful revolution took place in East Germany, when thousands of people gathered by the Berlin Wall. The East German government made the decision to open the wall rather than to mow down the demonstrators, rather than to repress it with force. And the world changed. No longer did Hoddle and his friends have to worry about how to get books from the West. No longer did they have to worry about what would happen after they prayed together in the church. A little bit of mustard seed had suddenly become a great shrub of potential and possibility. Next slide. So today, my friend Huddle lives in this village outside of Dresden, Germany, a town called, small, well, it's about 3,000 people. Groß Naundorf is its name. And after the peaceful revolution of 1989, he became a professor at a Protestant college, university in Dresden. Next slide. Here's the place where he teaches now in Dresden. Well, I guess he retired a couple of years ago, still does some part-time teaching. And here he is as he looks today with his wife, Beate, as they remember those days, as they needed each other so desperately. In fact, they recently gave a seminar in Dresden where they shared some of the letters that they had written to each other back and forth during his year of imprisonment. So what does it mean to be free? What does it mean for a Christian to be free when you're under the thumb of powers and principalities? The lesson that I learned from my friend Hoddle Wagner is that reading and thinking, expanding your knowledge, thinking deeply about life, thinking deeply about what makes for justice, gathering with other people to think together, that thinking, clear thinking, is something that Christians are called to. You know, today we take for granted, as I said, that we can order books online, We take for granted that we can think whatever we want to think. And thank goodness that we live in a society that mostly gives us those opportunities. But as Christians, not to take for granted, to remember the privilege of being able to read and think and ponder and try to understand what is God asking us to do and what makes for a just society. That we need clear thinking with the help of the best philosophers and theologians and sociologists, that clear thinking is a way of staying free as a Christian. And I wonder what that might mean for us in our time, where so much of our thinking, we have powerful forces in the media, we have powerful political forces, we have all kinds of people who want to tell us how we should think, who want to control how we will define our society, who want to manipulate us. And our call, even in our society, which is not communist or totalitarian, but our challenge as Christians, to keep thinking, to think clearly, to think deeply about our society and what makes for a better, more just society. It takes good, hard thinking with each other. We need each other. So, you know, when I visit Huddled, the first thing I notice when I walk into their apartment is there are books everywhere. I mean, it is just loaded with books. Now, not all of us are intellectuals, and not all of us are going to collect a big library of philosophy like he did. But that doesn't get us off the hook of trying to do the best thinking, the clearest thinking that we are called to do. So how can we keep reading? How can we keep thinking? What are the books that we need, whether from the Bible or philosophy or sociology or other books that will help us think about our society? How do we find those books? How do we gather together to think? And how do we cultivate a sense that thinking, good, hard, clear thinking, can help to keep us free from the powers and principalities of our time? Next slide. And then really to think of the church, to think of what he discovered was that the church provided a space, a free space where people could gather to pray and think. Can the church always be a place where people know they can gather to think hard thoughts, think clearly, and pray together as they work for a more just society? So this is the church in his village in Großnaundorf, where now he continues with other Christians to think about what will be good and just for German society today. Right, so let me pause there and would welcome your thoughts, your reactions. This idea that we need good, clear thinking with the help of the best minds and the help of each other in order to stay free in our society.
Were there other leaders like him in those other churches you mentioned that drove the prayer groups like he did? And did they know each other? Did they?
Yeah. So, you know, initially the people who were trying to think this alternative way for East German society, they were small. They were just a mustard seed, but they knew each other. They began to build networks. They began to support and encourage each other. So that was part of the interesting story, that what began as very disparate, isolated efforts, these people began to find each other and to share books, share thinking, talk together. And what was amazing is that out of those very small, humble beginnings, a whole movement began to grow that gathered more and more people. And that's not always the way it works in history, right? I mean, sometimes groups like that just remain small, isolated, and insignificant. But here was one instance where, you know, it wasn't a violent revolution that had to be planned with guns and weapons and conspiracies, but it was people committed to a different way of thinking that began to create an alternative space that drew in more and more people. Yeah, I think it's a fascinating story of how a peaceful revolution can happen, because people begin to think differently. They think thoughts that the government doesn't want them to think.
So I gather the people that assembled and climbed the Berlin Wall were risking their lives in their minds, because they didn't know, or did they, that the East German government decided to not kill them.
Yeah, the turning point was really about a month prior to the fall of the Berlin Wall. There was this church in Leipzig, which was one of the centers of gathering people for thinking together and praying together. They'd go out on the street afterwards with their candles. And in early October of 1989, that grew massively, so that in the procession, the march after the prayer service, other people would join in. And there were maybe 10,000 people marching through the heart of Leipzig. The government officials decided that the march, the procession, had to be disrupted. That people, this was getting out of control. It was getting bigger and bigger. And troops were ordered into Leipzig to arrest the people who were marching. We don't know the whole story, but apparently officials at the city level, not the government, the central government from Berlin, defied the orders and allowed the march to go on. And that seemed to be a signal at that time, something had shifted, something had changed. The government saw that it could no longer control through force. And so that seems to have been psychologically the turning point. And then a month later came the crowds gathering at the Berlin Wall, and again, the decision not to use force. And people just then began to climb the wall and to go through the checkpoints, and the government did not restrain them.
I'm just thinking broadly here, and you say the concept of allowing people to think and freedom to think. Now we have the internet, which supposedly provides people with access to all the information and encourages that type of thing. That can cause chaos too if it's not thinking along, if it doesn't have a Christian basis or something else that you believe in. So I'm wondering how that that concept there, when you give people freedom to, and access to unlimited information, how you control that.
Yeah, great question, because lots of news or lots of information isn't necessarily the information that you need. And I think one of the temptations, one of the maybe even powers and principalities of our time is we're told, oh, you're free. You know, you get any information you want from the internet, but we don't get things that really help us to think. They are constantly disorienting us, confusing us, making us shrug our shoulders. Who really has the truth? What is news? What is fake news? We kind of say, well, I can't figure it out anymore. And that's what the powers and principalities want. And we say, well, who knows who's right, who's wrong? So maybe in our time, the challenge is not a totalitarian government, but our challenge is to really find, as Christians, what you're suggesting. How do we find those books, those thinkers that help us think deeply about our faith and our commitment to a better society through our Christian faith? Because just going out there and finding all kinds of information isn't going to do it. And we need then the challenge in our time is to say, well, given this surplus of information and given this tidal wave of things we could be reading, how do we find the things that really help us and don't just distract us? I think that's not easy. That's not easy, but where we need really to, you know, it's kind of paradoxical, isn't it? In communist East Germany, the problem was getting a book at all from the West. Now we have more than enough books. Our challenge is, how do we find what will really help us think deeply, clearly, and not just, you know, so often we're like, we're just blown by, like, we're blown like leaves by the wind. Oh, we see this, we see that, we're stimulated by that idea, we're appalled, you know, we just are kind of blowing around in the wind. That's not going to help us think deeply or clearly. Well, I think there's somebody behind you first. But yeah.
I just found it so fascinating that a few people wanting to read books were put in prison, yet when the same people went to a church, they allowed that. So God's hand was definitely in that.
You know, the church in East Germany was the one place where there was a little bit of a free space, where the government still didn't control quite everything. And so that was where people who wanted to think differently began to gather. Yeah.
About philosophy, my knowledge is that the earliest philosophers, the Greeks, that didn't leave many writings, they had a sense of wonder, which was like this deep and serious thinking you're talking about. But not all philosophers have that. I mean, Marx was a philosopher, and some other philosophers have not so much a sense of wonder as a way of structuring reality as they see it. And I wonder about Jesus. Jesus isn't known as a philosopher, but he had powerful ideas. And so I see him as like the greatest of the philosophers, the greatest of, but he wasn't a thinker. He had knowledge. So I just want to make that comment.
Yeah.
But I myself have, you know, I'm a lawyer, so I'm aware of power in the legal system. I'm aware of political power. And maybe these are what you're calling the powers and principalities of the world. But the deep thinking is the most powerful thing we have. And so when your friend got together with other thinkers, I'm sure that's what motivated them. They were wondering, what is there more? Is there more to...
Right.
Yeah. So that sense of wonder is what's, I think, is the core of philosophy.
Yeah, no, I think that's a beautiful way of putting it, that what reading helped them to do was to imagine there can be an alternative. When you live in a society that says, this is just the way things are, accept it, you can't change it, then to be able to read in a way that helps you imagine things can be different, things can be better, things can be more just. They don't have to be the way that people say they have to be. That's what good, deep, clear thinking can do. And I think that that's why he got attracted to the parables of Jesus. It's true, Jesus doesn't write philosophical tractates, but the parables are deep, deep thinking about how to imagine a different world, how to imagine the world that God calls the world to be. I'm sorry? That's the mustard seed. Exactly. And so, no, not all of us will be called to read Kant and Hegel and Thomas Aquinas and all the books that you got your philosophical education in. But even things like parables can orient us when we're so disoriented. That's the kind of reading, the kind of thinking that I think we're called to do together as Christians. Okay, well, I think we're at our time, but thank you for letting me introduce you to a person who has touched my life, an ordinary saint, yet an extraordinary person in the way that he discovered what power lies in clear, deep thinking about a better, more just society. And the sun has come out to welcome us. So that's right.